Welcome to Creative Squares, where we discuss the intersection between art, science, maths, and technology. I'm Alex Lovelace.
I'm Mark Burden.
To kick off this podcast, we're going to cover one of the most well-known art maths crossovers, the golden ratio, aka the golden section, aka phi, aka 1.618033987, etc. The reason this is such a great starting point for this podcast is it turns up not only in maths and art, but in biology, engineering, architecture, computing, music, and points towards Renaissance, Da Vinci, Dali, Dan Brown, and presumably some other folks with names that don't start with DA. But are the golden ratio and other compositional paradigms merely a tyranny of conformity and an illusion of familiarity? That's what we're going to discuss today. But before we do, let's refamiliarize ourselves with what the golden ratio actually is. To understand the golden ratio, you first need to understand something called the Fibonacci sequence. Mark, do you want to take us through what that is and why it's important?
When I think about Fibonacci, I think about the natural forms in life and kind of like growth formations in nature, specifically plants. And Fibonacci is a number sequence that is defined by a series of numbers. And I'll just reel them out. 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13, 21. And you get the next number in the sequence by summing up the previous two. So in this case, we get the first two numbers in the sequence, 1 plus 1, and then we sum them up to get the third number, which equals 2. And then to get the next number in the sequence, we sum up 2 plus 1 to give us 3. And then we get 3 plus 2 equals 5, and so on. So we get an infinite number series based around integers, and it just carries on like that. And when we think about how that could be reflected in nature, you know, if we look at simple things like the formation of a tree, going from its main trunk to all of the little twigs and branches right at the end, it follows more or less a kind of like Fibonacci sequence, where the main trunk gets broken into two and then into three and so forth. And you end up with loads of little twiglets and bits at the end that, you know, in springtime transform into leaves.
Yeah, absolutely. And we see it on the petals of flowers tend to be one or other of the Fibonacci numbers. And it turns up in all sorts of weird places. I think people see it almost everywhere. It's one of those numbers that mathematicians get quite excitable about, a bit like pi and prime numbers, and want to know as much about as possible. But how does that the Fibonacci sequence relate to the golden ratio?
A good question, and in fact, it's to do with the way in which the proportions are built out. So, if you think about a rectangle, there's a particular proportion between the shorter side and the longer side that is harmonious, and that relates to the number phi. So if you take one side and divide it by the other side, you'll get the number phi, which is different from pi, and very easy to confuse the two if you're not used to phi and pi. But phi is that number, the 1.618 dot dot dot, which is a regular number and is as long as pi. But yeah, it's that ratio. So it creates a kind of like harmonious balance when you're looking at those two aspects on a rectangle. So shorter side versus longer side. And it's the proportion of which, when you're looking at the two, that creates this level of harmony that we see in nature.
So we have this rectangular shape with a spiral inside there that has been used most notably by people like Leonardo da Vinci, but many, many others, to aid composition of pictures and paintings. And I guess the theory here is that since the Fibonacci sequence is seen so frequently in sort of nature and in the real world, that it has some sense of aesthetic beauty that is inherent within nature, i.e. we find nature beautiful, the Fibonacci sequence stroke the golden ratio turns up in nature a lot, and therefore if you have your painting composition aligned with the golden ratio, then you draw a line between a comparison between your picture and the natural compositions in nature. And behind all of that, we have this mathematical construct, the sequence called the Fibonacci sequence.
Yeah, you're spot on there, Alex. And again, you know, when we think about the way in which the rectangle for the golden ratio that we're used to seeing in fine art and in compositional devices for fine art, it's made up of those series of squares, you know. So you get the 1 plus 1, and creates another square of 2 plus 2, and that creates another square of 3 plus 3 and 5 plus 5, and then we get the square of 8 plus 8. So you've got within this proportion rectangle a number of focal points. Which is different from what we potentially get with just a standard square. And I know that we both compose our art a lot of the time in terms of standard square. And the thing about the square is there's really only one center of focus, which tends to be the central point. But with the spiral shape, which is inherent in the Fibonacci series and the golden ratio, you get different points of interest. And typically this is where Leonardo and those early Renaissance paintings, they were using one point perspective plus the golden ratio to define their compositions, to give it a feeling of naturalism, but also of purity and symbolic power and harmony by using this mathematical device. So I think it's interesting that it was rediscovered by Fibonacci from other sources, and then it was used in the Renaissance to kind of create a different type of aesthetic that was supposedly more harmonious. But we can see that the proportions were used in a lot of temple building and important buildings of power. You know, these defined proportions that create a kind of a sense of harmony and a sense of power.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think Fibonacci didn't discover this sequence. It's been known about in various parts of the world for millennia. He was simply the person who popularized it in Europe, and it was instrumental in kicking off the Renaissance. He popularized quite a lot of other concepts at that time as well. And a lot of this thinking came from the East Asia, Islamic science and mathematics. It supposedly turns up in architecture. And it's been theorized that, you know, it was used in the construction of the Great Pyramids, for example, in Giza, which is a somewhat tenuous assertion, as far as I understand. We're getting to ancient alien territory here, but it turns up all over the place, and it tends to be a way to make things feel harmonious and to fit in with a natural sense of proportion and construction. And I think it's not dramatically different in some senses from like some of the other compositional rules, like the rule of thirds. And the sort of the classic art school, or even just school, art class at school, diktats around if you're painting someone or drawing a picture of someone as a portrait, don't have them dead center staring out at you, right? If you've got a vase of flowers and some other bits, and you want to create a composition where the vase of flowers is slightly offset to the side, and these are compositionally make a certain amount of sense, although you can find exceptions absolutely everywhere. Yeah. For these, I immediately thought, as soon as I said the vase of flowers, well, Van Gogh, the sunflowers are dead center as far as I remember. I broadly sort of agree with it. But the whole mystique that goes with the golden ratio is sort of something that transcends simple compositional rules. And not least the likes of Dan Brown and his the Da Vinci Code, and all the conspiracy theory stuff that happens around that, that people, when they see the golden ratio, or they think they see the golden ratio in use, then there's something more deeply symbolic going on than simply, don't place things dead center. For example, the Mona Lisa, right, has that composition.
Yeah, that's right. The Mona Lisa is completely dominated by the Fibonacci sequence, or the golden section. So it's amazing when you place on the Fibonacci grid to the Mona Lisa, you just find that almost every single aspect of the composition is based around an underlying mathematical, sacred geometry or divine geometry.
So if you've got the Fibonacci square with the spiral, with the down point of the spiral downwards, so you're looking at it from a portrait perspective, would Mona Lisa's face be where the middle of the spiral is? Is that what we're saying here?
It's pretty much like that, if I remember correctly, yes.
And so I'm actually looking at the portrait behind my head there. That's one of my, it's not really a portrait, it's just a painting, one of my paintings. Actually, I don't think that's an appropriately proportioned rectangular painting, but I suspect that is almost Fibonacci-ish where I've put her face there, right? Which is not, in fact, there's two of them. Look, the other side of my head, they're both sort of in that same place. And so most, for historically, when people have been doing portraits, they tend to sit like Mona Lisa does, right? So I don't see a massive, you can put the Fibonacci spiral on that and have it roughly at her in the middle of the face. But what else is there? Is there more going on there than that?
I think that's interesting. I mean, I think there was, especially when you look at the early Renaissance, a lot of the paintings are based around the underlying mathematical principle of composition. So Bernini or any of the North European artists who are kind of like contemporaries of Leonardo and Michelangelo and Raphael were also using that as a compositional device. And so it's more than just how we frame a portrait. It's to do with the fact that it was an idea of, let's make this a harmonious experience, even if we're depicting something that is more difficult to digest, which in some ways, some of the Christian iconography, was. Some of the Renaissance paintings that relate to Christian iconography, the shooting of Saint Sebastian, shot to pieces with arrows and stuff like that. There's a level of violence in the image, and yet at the same time, there's a harmonious composition that allows you to contemplate that level of violence or level of martyrdom, if you want to look at it from that perspective. So I think there's a kind of intuitive way in which the audience engages in the art that gives them a kind of like a harmonious high, but it's also because of the harmony, because of our association with that harmony, it's something that gives a level of attraction that can be manipulated, I guess. And that's kind of interesting in one sense, but also, as you kind of like hinted at, there's a level of tyranny to that particular aesthetic. If you've seen it too much, you may get a little bit bored with it. And, it may just all be a little bit too harmonious, and you don't think the world is quite like that. So it's not a reflection of our everyday reality in that sense.
Well, or not there at all, right? And so yeah. there's no hard and fast rules that the number of petals on flowers tend to be Fibonacci numbers. Although there's some various theories about the fact why if it really is a pattern, why that might be, because apparently the Fibonacci sequence is quite an efficient way of packing things in. So seeds within within flowers often follow roughly some sort of Fibonacci-like rule. And you can see that from the way that the golden ratio rectangle is divided up. It's an extremely efficient way of packing things. So it's not beyond the realms of credulity that over billions of years, nature found certain ways of maximizing for space and efficiency, because that's simply what natural selection does. So I can get for one point where, yeah, okay, maybe that there's a rule, a general rule around, you know, flower petals and Fibonacci, and maybe Fibonacci turns up more often than would be represented by pure chance. But to jump from that to the Mona Lisa, to the pyramids, you start to get a little bit of waft of confirmation bias, because you can just take any, you know, any house, because houses certainly in this country are generally rectangular, and start to let's take this measurement to this measurement. Oh no, that's not, you know, that's not the golden ratio. But if I take this measurement to this measurement, it is. Well, hold on, you know, that's not exactly a rigorous scientific process. And so, I'm not massively convinced that the golden section is different from the rule of thirds in any dramatic way. And I'm not massively convinced it's actually there where people say it is. Now, the flip side to that is that we know it's in Da Vinci's paintings because he told us, right? We know apparently it's in some of Bach's compositions. Yeah. American prog metal band Tool recorded the whole album Lateralis that centers around the Fibonacci sequence in the beat and the structure of the songs in the album. So it definitely is there, but, you know, Lateralis is a hard listen. Like, it's a hard album to listen to, and it's really long and complicated, and almost nothing repeats, right? And from that sense, you know, aesthetics or harmony, I'm not sure most people would say theming a whole album around Fibonacci led to a more harmonious album. I think most people will argue the exact opposite, unless, of course, you're a Tool fan. So, I mean, that's my question. Is it really improving things? You know what I mean? Or is it just a convention that has emerged and has attached to it a slightly higher degree of emphasis?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of those things that people get interested in, and then they push it back and say, oh, it's a bit old-fashioned, we'll do something else. But within the history of art, it's one of those themes that people seem to keep going back to. You know, it's a source of interest and curiosity, and you use it, and then you maybe put it in the bin for a while, or it goes out of fashion, and you end up having a different focus. But I think you mentioned when we were chatting before about, you know, the abstract compositions of Mondrian. And again, you know, if you look at those compositions, you think, well, they're just abstract, they're quite pleasant. But when you do the analysis, you find out that they're based around, you know, a lot of golden section proportions within the canvas. So whether that's something that happened intuitively, or whether that's something that was kind of like pre-programmed and pre-designed and pre-composed, different question. I was very interested in looking at Marcel Duchamp's large glass, this kind of like techno image of intelligent emotional machines interacting with each other. And again, you know, I wasn't aware that he would ever use something like the golden ratio. But in all of the drawings he did, which are the precursor to the large glass, he was using the golden ratio. And so that whole composition, not usually mentioned in a lot of the historical literature around the large glass, is completely based around the golden section. And I mean, he said it was a kind of like a mechanical approach to doing art, but it's interesting that that was a kind of like a level of aesthetic that he was using. Crops up everywhere, and then you think, oh no, there's just too much bias, and no, I don't want my stuff to look like everyone else's. So it's just
and precisely right. And so if we take this sort of idea of the composition of the Mona Lisa, which is also just a fairly sensible and pleasing composition for any waist up portrait for your average school photo, right? And that's cool, right? And I don't really think that paradigm needs to be massively disrupted. But then you get this idea that, well, why is it like that? Well, this person did it before, or who copied this person did it for, who copied this person who did it before, and some of them may have been aware of the compositional imposition of the golden ratio, but most people were just sort of going, well, when I see portraits, this is what they look like. I base my work on X, on Mondrian, and therefore when you look at it, you'll find that there's some golden ratio in there, and we get a certain convergence because this is the paradigm or the standard way of composing pictures within a rectangle, and so we get this self-fulfilling thing that keeps going and going and going, and to the point where when someone violates the rule, either the rule of thirds or the golden ratio or one of the others, people look at that and go, oh, that makes me uncomfortable, that's a bit weird, that's a bit off. But what's going on there? You know, there's this idea that, oh no, we have these compositions because we see them naturally in nature, but I don't think that's at all clear. I don't think that's at all a done deal. And therefore, are they only uncomfortable simply because they're used to seeing things in that composition, artificial things in that composition, and that actually had Da Vinci decided to use some other method of composition, that everyone at this point would be going, oh, look, there's Mona Lisa, as we always see us, you know, doing a headstand or something.
No, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, a lot of art is based around this idea of repetition. We're told what art is, we're told what it looks like, and in some ways it's a kind of a meme that is kind of like manipulated through time. And therefore, if something looks a bit like art and smells a bit like art, then we make a connection to say, think it's probably is art. And then you've also always got artists throughout the history of art since the Renaissance anyway, you know, that want to just do something different. Oh, I don't like that. I can make it a bit more naturalistic. I can put a bit more shadow to this. I can make it a bit more exciting. I can give a different subject matter, blah, blah, blah. So they're always, artists always change the rules, and they hate rules, really. They like some of them some of the time, but if they get in the way, they want to get rid of them. And I think it's a bit the same with, you know, the harmonies of the golden section, the harmonies of Fibonacci, and the fact that there's a level of tyranny to it as well. It makes you ask the question, can you have something beautiful, or can you have something visually interesting and stimulating that is not the golden section? And of course, the answer is yes. But as we move into this area of AI-generated work and mathematical patterns supporting, you know, a lot of the artificial intelligence and machine intelligence, then we have different philosophical questions about, you know, what's the nature of aesthetics? Are we creating a closed loop via the algorithms that machine intelligence is using to continually generate like-minded art? So, you know, something that has got the same DNA as its precursors. I don't think it needs to be like that, but I think there may be algorithms in the background that make these things that look like art and kind of smell like art use these patterns to make them more convincing and more appealing to human vision and eyes and intellect.
There's quite a lot to unpack there, and we're not going to do it all today. There's definitely some more
We may need another conversation.
Might need another few hundred. But some points that jump out. One is that the flip side to the conformity is that if there are no rules to break, then you can't break any rules. And as you point out, artists like breaking rules. And making art isn't always about aesthetics and making things look pleasing. When you subvert the standards on composition and it makes people uncomfortable, well, then you probably meant them to feel uncomfortable, right? And if that's what you wanted, then that's a piece of art. It's fit for the purpose for which it was designed. And of course, there are always going to be, just through pure brute force statistics, a centre ground, right? A more popular way of doing things. And so that happens to be the Fibonacci sequence, the golden section, the rule of thirds and these things. And could it have been different is an open question. Does it matter at this point? Probably not, because that's where people have coalesced anyway. Right. Now, when you touch on the whole AI thing, that's where things start to get mega thorny, because obviously you take something like DALL-E or Midjourney, one of these generative AI algorithms and models that produce images based on text instructions, i.e., give me a picture of a Volkswagen Beetle in the style of Van Gogh, right? Which it would probably do a decent enough job of, and you probably weren't looking for a great masterwork there anyway. Maybe just needed a graphic for your blog or something. Now, those models have learned, rightly or wrongly, that has learned from everything that is found on the internet, which includes probably a billion photo snaps, but a lot of images of the great masters, of painters, all through history, many of which will have used very standard compositional practices, which the machine is learning. It's not learning in the sense that it knows what it's doing. It's simply saying, well, when I see pictures, they usually look like this. So if you want a portrait, it's probably going to be roughly golden ratioed, and then it all gets compounded, and everything starts to feel more and more homogeneic, because these models can't be creative. It's simply they're not intelligent. The artificial intelligence moniker is a massive misnomer. And that they're simply regurgitating and vomiting out stuff that they've seen before, and they're going to vomit out in roughly the way they've seen it before. And therefore, the more AI art that gets out there, the more homogeneity there's going to be around things like composition and structure. You get to this point where, you know, are we ever going to see anything that looks different ever again? And it's quite depressing in that sense.
Yeah, I know. It's going to be interesting to see where it goes. I mean, the AI-generated art, I mean, it's a word prompt versus a visual prompt or a material prompt. And that means that the work is generated. It doesn't have a level of materiality until it's printed out, or it forms into some form of 3D printing, I guess. You know, you can imagine that something like that may happen in the not too distant future, unless it probably happened already, because jewelry design is now being created by 3D printers and stuff like that. So, you know, this whole mishmash of hybrid compositions by machines and humans is already happening.
I've been using large language models much more than I've used the image based ones, and I use them for either writing text as a bit of a shortcut, mm-hmm. or by, you know, I get them sometimes to do coding for me in Python. And what I've found is that I have a way I want to do things. It's fairly specific to how I work and just how I learned those languages and so on, or how I write my blog, my blog posts or podcast episodes and things like that. And then, so you get it. So can you write some code to do this? And it writes it in a certain way. And I'm like, no, I don't want it done that way. Right. So you go into it and you say, well, no. Okay. Can you do it again, but write it this way? And it doesn't want to. Right. It's simply like, no, I can't do it that way. Can only do it this way. Right. And if you've ever done any programming, but it's the same with creative writing, it's, there's an infinite way, number of ways to do anything. And but it only wants to do it in the prevalent way. Now, whether I'm right or wrong to want it be done differently, it's kind of beside the point. Just shut up and do what I told you. But it doesn't, it's not being belligerent. It's just saying, I just don't understand. You're going to have it done this way because it's the only way, right? And I can see that with art, right? And so by using AI to do things like design or even composition or anything like that for artists using it for creating references for figure drawing or something, right? You can't get it to compose it differently. It just is too much effort, and therefore, like, it is going to have that impact everywhere, all over the place, of sort of driving this homogeneity of composition and appearance of art. It just seems very likely to me, and that's quite sad. But also, if you want to stand out, then don't do it that way. Have square artworks, for example, Mark.
I think that could be very interesting, yeah. I mean, I think the challenge with square artworks is that you have to work harder at the compositions.
But, well, I do. And I love squares, and I can see one there on my shoulder. And I love my other favourite aspect ratio is 2:1. Whichever way that is, the portrait version of 2:1. Another one that forces you to do interesting stuff with compositions, and not something that you can easily apply Fibonacci to, although I'm very likely doing some version of the rule of thirds. It tends to be my go-to, but mostly I just do this intuitively anyway, right? And so how do you compose a painting? Well, I move things around until it looks good to me, right? Do you, stick a grid across the canvas or something? No, I don't, right? You know, sometimes I'll use them because if I'm playing around with compositions within like iPhoto or something, it automatically imposes a grid. It's sometimes quite helpful, especially if I want to get things centered, which you're not supposed to do, which I do all the time. And it's a bit of a case of, it's always been intuitive to me. Now, someone will come in this house and, mathematically analyze all my paintings and tell me that, oh, no, they're all Fibonacci. You know what I mean? They're all absolutely, you must be some sort of genius because they're all absolutely perfect golden ratio. But I certainly have never used it. Have you?
No, I've always found it too difficult. It's never worked for me. So I'm very intuitive in terms of the way that I construct compositions. But if I'm looking at historical paintings, I'm amazed by how much of the underlying composition can be based around the golden section. So that for me has been an interesting insight. Certainly over the course of the last few years, just to look at the compositions and notice how much of them are based around these mathematical proportions. And the question that you hint at there, Alex, is, are we going with this new machine intelligence world that we're creating, or the machines are creating themselves, are we going to see more of those mathematical patterns in terms of output, or a processing power to that overall composition? And I think artists can then decide whether they want to use that or whether they just rely on their intuition and their visual skills to be able to balance things out, whether it's a center-defined composition or whether it's not. But I think there's a lot of things that humans do intuitively that machines find incredibly difficult to do. But there's certainly something in there in terms of, watch this space, how is it going to evolve? what's our relationship to that involvement? You know, are we going to be doing more stuff that's hybrid? Are we going to do more stuff that's completely intuitive and doesn't look anything naturally like Fibonacci, but may still have that Fibonacci element to it when someone comes along and analyzes it later?
Well, that's it, right? So you've got a pattern within a pattern within a pattern. You've got turtles all the way down. There's something specifically recursive about this conversation, you know, the Fibonacci is a recursive function, and so is it there? Well, we know that pi is there, right? Pi is there because every time you see a circle, there's pi, right? There's no ambiguity about this. The Fibonacci sequence definitely exists because you can do it, and it can be extrapolated to pretty extreme lengths. But is it there in nature? It's less clear, right? But we assume that it is, and as you sort of zoom out in a sort of fractal sense, yes, maybe you do see it in a lot more places, and maybe it depends on your lens and your zoom level on sort of human culture and which particular features you zoom in on. Maybe it's much more present, and cynics like me can just shut the hell up. But I'm being a bit of a devil's advocate here because it's an interesting conversation, right? And I tend to be quite skeptical by nature, and I tend to quite like pushing against people with things that to me resemble conspiracy theories or just generally finding patterns where they probably don't exist. But also largely because I just don't care, right? I think it's an interesting subject, but I just don't have any use for it. And so I can sort of take any stance I want on this one. I'll probably keep being somewhat cynical about the whole thing until someone proves to me more concretely. But on the math side, there's whole journals written on the Fibonacci sequence. So I suspect there's much more to be found there. And I do wonder whether there's certain ways you can line up the Fibonacci numbers and create something aesthetically pleasing that way. But I'm sure someone's tried it.
Probably have. I mean, and again, you know, we may find with the images rather than the portraits that you do, the images that you use the head, you probably find that there's a level of Fibonacci just in terms of the proportions of different aspects of the head, you know, relationship, the eyes to the nose, to the mouth and chin and forehead and so forth. You know, there's probably something there, but, you know, I don't think that's the meaning of the work you're doing. It's just inherent in the fact that you're using a representational image of a head. So I think, yes, you know, we need to be a little bit careful about how pervasive Fibonacci in the golden section is in the natural world, and cautious in terms of its interpretation and, you know, a level of bias in art history, whether that's traditional or, you know, this kind of new stuff that's coming out of machines.
Well, chicken and egg, right? And now you're going to tell me that the egg is somehow in the shape of a Fibonacci or something.
I'm sure it is. I'm sure it is. I'm a believer today, so I don't buy any of your cynicism.
Right, I think probably we'll wrap this one up. I know we could have gone deeper on any number of aspects on this. And the reason we're not doing that is simply because we know we're going to have to come back to it, whether we do more episodes on the Fibonacci and the golden section, or whether it just turns up. I'll be astounded if we don't do something on the Renaissance and delve down on more of Da Vinci stuff. We've got to talk about the Last Supper and all that type of thing. This stuff is going to come back up again, so we will definitely revisit, but probably won't be for a little while. But I think we're done. So thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you again soon. Bye.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for your time, and thanks for listening and being engaged. If you have any questions, let us know.